finally not here on stage at the launch of this latest book. Just want to say it doesn't get easier. I've spent a fair amount of time on stages talking or being talked to, and it's always slightly traumatic. So, although it really is a pleasure, and finally, I'm hoping, despite his stylistic similarities to Jane Goodseer, is not going to be quite as terse as J.M. Fani, welcome to Cape Town. I say that because these days you're something of an exile. And you don't refer to Cape Town in flattering terms in your novel. There are several quite disparaging quotes, but I'll settle just for one. So, welcome to this miserable city with the sea on both sides.
Thank you very much.
Is that really how you feel about it?
I think that's a thought of one of my characters, so I wouldn't want to appropriate it.
We all hide behind characters. I've used it behind myself.
But the soundboard from where I come is something of a different country. You know, they do things differently there.
Right, I believe you. I mean, there is a serious intent behind the question, because not just with this novel, in almost everything you've written, there is quite a sense of far-flung backgrounds for the stories that you get into. In this particular book, we go from London to Germany, to Serbia, to South Africa, to Tokyo, back to South Africa, off to the English countryside. It's a loaded question, but do you feel like a South African? Are you writing as a South African?
It's a good question and a difficult one to answer. And one that I may answer somewhat differently now than I would have, I think, a few years ago. The outlines of my biography, I spent my youth in South Africa, and then I left the country to study elsewhere, study in the UK and in America, and then ended up practicing as a lawyer, a corporate lawyer, that is, in New York for a few years, and then in London for a very long time. A life which, not to go into it in detail, but which was quite alienating, in part, I think, because of the profession I was in, and part because of, I think maybe let me go back a step further to my youth, as a sort of a queer child in South Africa in the 70s and 80s, which was in itself quite an uncomfortable place for me. It was a place where one didn't really feel at home in any sort of meaningful way, and I was plotting my escape for quite a long time, and then it's ultimately one ends up in the Northern Hemisphere, and that escape, or what you imagined the escape to be, doesn't necessarily pan out either. One ends up in a sort of a place which is a nowhere or an in-between place, it's hard to, I think, ever return completely from that specific place. And in part, I don't want to sort of romanticize it, but in part it's something temperamental. In part it's just, as I say, one's sort of life experience in terms of the way one has lived. But then I think at some point one reaches the point where you can make that in-betweenness, that sort of not-at-home-ness, into something productive. You can turn it into something that may generate creative energy. And I hope that's what I've done. I'm often surprised myself at the number of approximately the sheer number of countries that, that feature in my short stories and my novels. And there's something, I think something sometimes happens where the narrative has to be propelled by being moved geographically from one place to another. Sometimes I think when things get stuck, you know, moving the characters somewhere else helps. It makes it move again. But your question was actually quite a simple one: is do I feel like a South African? The question is perhaps does anyone, and what does it feel like to feel like? What does it feel like to feel like a South African? I think the last few years, in particular, I think in part just the fact that we seem to be governed by a mafia state at the moment, in itself seems like quite an alienating factor. And of course, we're a society that consists of all these communities that seem to exist in parallel, who live in very, have a very different worlds within the same country. So whatever it means to be a South African, I think people have very different notions of it in different communities. I think there's, among white South Africans, there's historically been a almost sort of German type of notion of home, something along the lines of a Heimat, sort of a 19th century idea of what it means to be at home. And I think one should be quite, careful of harking back to that or seeing that as what it is being to what it is to be feel South African. It's quite dangerous, can be, the notion of the word Lebensraum seems to be conjured up. But that's a very long-winded answer to a short question.
Well, no, but it does open up lots of channels for discussion. And perhaps we can come back in an oblique way to this question. I remember in my introduction, which I wrote to your first collection of stories, The Alphabet of Birds, I remarked that South Africa in your stories feels like a condition rather than a place. And you've described South Africa in this book as a country that has always felt like a strange wind on the skin of your main character, a kind of condition, really. In earlier stories, the reason that characters come back, there is always a reason of some sort. It's very often tied up with, again, from an earlier phase, characters coming back because a mother is dying. This book very clearly plants its flag in fatherhood as a subject. And I wonder if you could just, I'd rather you did this than me, if you could, because I'm assuming lots of people here would not have read your book. How have you structured this book? And, how did it come about? What drove you to write it, and what made you shape it in the particular way that you have?
I'll certainly answer the question, but maybe just one comment on which you've on the comments that you've made before asking that question is what some South African reviewer on my when reading my short stories remarked that they seem to be I seem to have no interest in the social history of South Africa, but rather in the lives of double passport holders or something along those lines, which was one of the silliest remarks I've ever actually encountered on my writing. It's something about the characters and their bi-passport rules. I think South Africa is very much it's almost like an acute absence, I think, at the heart of each story. And they are probably, for all their frenetic traveling around, they are very, very deeply rooted in the absent country at the heart of them. Be that as it may, the question was about this book and the structuring of it. My first novel was quite an odd sort of, had quite an odd sort of gestation in the sense that I wrote a very extensive project plan for a grant and then received the grant to write the novel. And then, you know, was sort of stuck with a 30, 40 page proposal for a novel, which turned out to be quite a weight on one's foot. And I was actually surprised at how close the end product was to the proposal, not in all respects, but in many respects. My temperament or my instinct is far more oriented towards short fiction or shorter forms of fiction. I'm kind of annoyed at the current day focus on the novel as the only valid form, in a sense, certainly the only, in many countries, according to publishers, the only viable form of prose, less so in the US. My own creative energy, I think, is much more efficiently expended across the arc of a long full story than.
But there's a way to understand this book or to read this book as almost a constructed out of five long short form pieces, if you know what I'm saying.
Absolutely, and I mean, it had its to get to your actual question. It had its origin in, well, the first part one was in fact a short story to start with. Which then, my sense is often that there's some sort of nodes in the story that don't feel as if they've fully expended their energy. There's a character that would stay with me, or some sort of notion of something that might have happened, some aspect of plot that seems to not be have been exhausted in that story.
Okay, so to be specific, the first section is about this man, Daniel, who is a writer, it seems.
Yeah.
He's in London and he encounters in an almost arbitrary way these two Serbian guys.
Yes.
And he gets into a very complicated sexual, semi-emotional connection with both of them, which takes him first to Germany and then to Serbia. So, what was the part of this that felt unfulfilled?
Well, let me approach the question from a slightly different angle. I can actually zoom into the, often one doesn't know the deeper origins of a novel or a story quite often. You might think you know what the seed is, but then it often isn't. In this case, I had a pretty good idea, actually. I think it actually started with the title of the first piece, which is Where the Wolves Mate. And I think I read in a British newspaper when Donald Trump spoke about African countries as shithole countries. In some Serbian newspaper, the phrase was translated, and then some British journalist directly translated that phrase into English, and the English version of, or the English translation of the Serbian word for shithole was the place where the wolves mate. So I think that phrase stuck with me, and in fact, when I lived in London, I knew that a Serbian couple. I didn't have the same kind of relationship with them that my productness here does with the two Serbians.
Somewhat relieved to hear that.
I won't express regrets. And also I'm a big fan of the American artist, one of the few female minimalists of that era, Agnes Martin. And these, you know, these three disparate elements somehow came together in the short story. I can't quite, you know, it's of course easy to try to reverse engineer these things and try to imagine retrospectively how or why this, you know, this one brings these, this one's unconscious brings these disparate elements together. But those three elements somehow fused and became a short story.
Okay, but then we move on, and Daniel is in the second section,
yes,
here in Cape Town, and he's tending to his dying father.
Yes.
I don't want to bog you down in detailed, sure, descriptions of each section, but I wonder if you could give us a sense of each section of the book, because there are quite large jumps of time between some of them.
Yes.
And they're bound more thematically than anything else, yeah?
Sure, they do. Essentially, there are five parts of the novel. The first four parts have the same protagonist, Daniel. The four parts are could be read independently. They could be read, I think, in short stories, each of them. They could stand on their own legs, but they do chronologically follow on each other. The first part is more like an epilogue. A piece that binds the other parts together, I would say. And yes, the first three parts follow quite shortly upon each other, and then there's roughly a 12-year and then an 18-year gap between the fourth and the fifth part. So yes, the first part, Daniel lives in London. He's a kind of freelance journalist and a fiction writer who writes little short pieces of cultural journalism for British papers, but he also returns to Cape Town, where he's from at times, and he then befriends these Serbians, as you mentioned, and has some odd sort of relationship with them. In the second part, he is back in South Africa a year or so later, where his father, who's now demented, he's quite wealthy, some of those fathers, is now demented, and he essentially cares for him, one could call it that, for the last few weeks of his life. His father then passes away, and I didn't want to think for us for this, but then his father passes away. His father's will specifies that as a condition for Daniel inheriting his half of the estate, that Daniel should visit his cousin in the Free State on the old family farm, his mother's, of the family on his mother's side. And then he goes and looks up this cousin whom he hasn't seen since childhood. And then the plot unfolds from there. There's a sick child. And he and his cousin take this child to Tokyo for treatment, and it unfolds from there. But indeed, sorry, just to go back to the question maybe around genre, I think my frustration with the fact that it seems very difficult these days to convince people that there are more forms than just the long form. To my mind, there's a sort of continuum, you know, and this is probably somewhere in between the novel and short stories, I would have thought.
I certainly read it as a novel. It sort of was a retrospective realization that actually those pieces could be standalone. And I wonder at what point, thematically, you decided this is a whole and it's bound together by, you know, the theme of, well, it's the theme of fatherhood, but I also want to ask you about, you know, you give the book the title of Fathers and Fugitives. I can see the element of fatherhood in each section of the book, one way or another. There are either actual fathers or substitute fathers playing their part to whatever degree of effectiveness. Where from the fugitive element, and how does that connect to fatherhood? again, I can see it in some sections and certain characters, but I'm wondering at the connection between those two.
I think each of the significant characters in the book is fleeing from something. You know, I guess Daniel is fleeing from South Africa, is fleeing from what he experiences as a domineering, distant father. I think the Serbian friends are fleeing from Serbia, trying to flee from Serbia, the Serbia that they present as, you know, inhospitable or hostile, as to queer men.
But do you see an innate connection? I mean, you're a father yourself.
Sure.
Does it bring out the desire to flee in you? Because
sometimes. Occasionally. No, I'm not sure. Well, I think each of the characters has an absent father or a father with whom they've had a difficult relationship, a complex, problematic relationship, and perhaps as a result of that absence or that difficulty, they each seem to be constantly fleeing. So I think in this specific case, the fatherhood and the fleeing, or the absence of fatherhood and the fleeing, seem to be connected.
Mm.
I'm not sure that's necessarily inherently always the case.
Okay. This might be a good moment to ask you to do a short reading for us, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure.
A request has come by your publisher that you read in Afrikaans. There may be some people here who would prefer to read the Afrikaans version, but if not, we'll get a flavor of it regardless.
So,
I'm trying to think whether I need to contextualize it. I don't think I do, actually. Let me just read. And as Stephen said, I'm reading in Afrikaans. Op 'n maandag ruk na 'n middagete. Vrugte en brood, waarvan sy pa skaars enigiets eet, gaan stap weer in die hitte wat bewegingloos in die stadskom hang. Hulle stop hulle gewoonte vir koffie. Toe hulle so teenoor mekaar sit, raak sy pa verskonend, as sy vir hom nou gewild voel tot 'n graad van interaksie. Jammer, ek is ongesellig, sê hy, en ach, ek wil toch net my ou dag op my kinders se nekke lê nie. Dis niks, wat Daniel homself sê, is geen las nie. Dis toch net belangrik dat ons hier saam is. Eindelijk wil hy opstaan en sy pa hier achterlaat, wegloop. Nie terug na die woonstel nie, maar kortpad op teen sy neewel, verby Leeukop, op teen Tafelberg, so ver as wat hy kan. Sonder om eenmaal af te kyk na die enkel figuur wat hier onder by die tafeltjie vir twee plek sit. Sonder dat hy dit so beplan, begin hy vir sy pa wat een van sy vorige verhoudings in Londen vertel. Al herken sy pa nog sy kinders, is daar skaars enige herinneringe oor. Wat sy pa vroeër van Daniel se geweet het, is weliswaar nie veel nie. Daar was min inligting om saam die breinweefsel weg te krimp. Hulle het in ten minste die dosyn jare nooit oor 'n enkele aspek van mekaar se persoonlike lewe gepraat nie. Sy pa sou wel geweet het dat Daniel op ongereelde grondslag tussen Londen en Kaapstad pendel, dat hy soms stukkies politieke en kulturele journalistiek vir Britse en Suid-Afrikaanse koerante neerpen, dat hy tussendeur fiksie skryf. Verdagte soort aktiwiteite, ek en sy pa, die beleggingspapier, bankier, sy eerder eertydse wêreld van finansiële tussengangerskap en moeilik daarmee te versoen. Jare gelede, toe sy pa sy goedkeuring nog getel het, het Daniel as bestuurskonsultant in Londen gewerk. Op die soort lewe wat hy deesdae lei, sal sy pa geen greep kan kry nie, by uitstek nie op sy verhoudingslewe nie. Wat Daniel nou vertel hy wat hy weet, sy pa sal het oor 'n uur of twee vergeet, of dalk 'n minuut of twee. En seker ook om die stilte te verbreek. Ek kies lukraak een ou verhouding, daar is geen tekort as dit is nie. Ek moet jou vertel van Eamon, pa, een van my ex-minnaars daar in die noorde, een eer. Hy het 4 jaar gelede binne ingetrek in Londen en is so 11 maanden daarna weer terug Dublin toe. Sy pa glimlag net. Daniel delf van die besonderhede van een reis wat hy in Eamon onderneem het. Hoekom Daniel juist hierdie brokkie kies, weet hy nie, maar is wat hy opkom. Hier in die stadskom wat so bedreiglik koesterend lyk. Hy vertel van alweer in Oost-Ierland waar Eamon groot geword het. Hy kyk na sy paas bevroore glimlag en wasige oë, terwyl hy die eerste landskap in besonderhede beskryf. Dan vertel hy van sy en Eamon se oggende in 'n beknopte gastehuis, versier met eerste kitsch vir die menigte Amerikaanse toeriste wat hulle van familiewortels kom naspeur. Hy kyk reguit na sy pa terwyl hy uitbrei oor die amper ontraaglike genot wat hy en Eamon soggens aan mekaar se lywe gehad het. Daar tussen prente van klaverblare en grynsende groen kabouters, terwyl die son oor die Ierse see opkom. Daniel word stil, probeer sy pa se oë lees. Hy wil beeld, selfs net een, uit sy kinderjare daarin vind. Van hom en sy pa saam, net twee van hulle. Pa en seun wat bal skop, seun op pa se skouers in 'n swembad. Ek had niffeling en gelag op een grasperk en stene. Maar die oor is leeg. Alwaar met sy eie sielsoog voor een dag kom, of hy het optover van hou is onduidelik, is hy en sy pa ewers op een winterstrand, dalk in die Kaap, dalk op die Europese reis, woordeloos in die wind. Daniel wat sy pa stip dophou, die pa wat sy hande in sy sakke steek, die seun wat hom dadelijk nahaap. Die beeld verswind so snel as dat het gekom het. Hy kyk na die passiewe figuur oorkant om, na die betekenislose glimlag. Hy wat sy pa gryp en skud, sy brein tot aksie skok.
It's a pleasure to hear you read that in Afrikaans, and it's an almost incidental question, but it's probably an appropriate moment to ask. This is the first book of yours that you've allowed somebody else to translate, is that correct?
Yes, indeed.
Why did you do that? Because your facility with English is quite sophisticated, and you've translated your own work before.
I think the best answer is that it's largely a practical concern.
Michiel needed work.
Michiel was broke and begged me. I think the fact that I have a child, it's the first time that I've published a book actually it's not the first time, it's the second time, but I'm more jealous perhaps of my writing time, of which there seems to be precious little. So I think that was part of it. One spends such an enormous amount of time with your own work when you translated it as well. Something quite quite exhausting and a little bit depressing about it in the end. Go through all production process of editing and proofreading and whatnot. And if there's sort of rewriting through the process of translation thrown in as well, that is does make it quite arduous. And I think there's also something around experimenting with how it would work, if one asks someone else. Of course, there's certain comfort and convenience about doing it yourself, in the sense that you don't, as a translator, you don't have to consult the novelist, you can just do whatever you want, and it's just you and your computer. Whereas, in this case, you've got Michiel, who's an accomplished novelist and a very experienced translator. We've got Henrietta Rose Innes, who edited, who also an accomplished novelist, also a translator, also an experienced editor. And you've got Nelleke, my publisher and editor, publisher, is also a highly experienced editor. So there were lots of people in the room this time around. It's quite humbling in a sense to have that all that talent to come to bear on one's work. It could also go terribly wrong, I suspect. I think in this case it worked out well. I mean, if I read the English, I think it's a very good result, and I think it's probably better than my own translations, I would say, ultimately.
Okay, that's an interesting reply. I thought it might come down to language and rather than time constraints, but that's
there is of course the fact that even if one is a facility in a second language, that might be 5 or 10% less than what one has in your first language. That when you write a prefiction, that counts. And I have translated my own work in the past and felt fine, but as I say, in part it was probably largely practical, but in part it was also testing how it would work out if I didn't do it myself.
So Daniel is your kind of alter ego in this particular book, or you may not think of him that way. There's several references to how he feels about writing fiction. I've only sort of plucked two almost at random. Writing fiction is a disruptive compulsion. And also, writing is what happens in the overflow. The passage suggests that writing is what happens when you stop thinking about writing, when you give up on it. That's when writing actually begins. How do you go about your compulsive disruption?
Well, alter ego or not, I don't necessarily want to take full responsibility for Daniel's perspective on fiction writing. And of course, I'd love to ask you these questions, but I guess that's not how the game works. Yes, I don't know. I would say that both of those things are probably essentially true for me. I don't know, you've been doing this for a very, very long time, and I don't know how one's perspective on what writing is, or how it works, what kind of psychological conditions have to be created for us to be remotely possible. It's hard, very hard to find some sort of formula as to what it is that enables one or allows one to get to a point where you can sit down and actually find some momentum with the writing. But I would say that both of those things are true. I think this specific novel was, as I say, very different than the previous novel, which was written as a sort of project, which there was a project plan. This one happened certainly much more, I was cringe a little bit when I say organic, but it happened in a somewhat organic fashion in the sense that it was the first short story, and then in fact, the second part was also written as a companion piece, as a second short story, and then it became a novel, but still written as these rather episodic pieces. As I say, you have far more experience than I, but the process of writing seems to be, it often has quite modest beginnings, and then it seems to gain some sort of momentum if you're lucky, and then there is a point at which the momentum seems to be generating itself, as if the pen is making its own patterns on the paper. That's a relatively rare occurrence, I think. But there seems to be some sort of mix between thinking and driving things forward and relying on this on intuition and the unconscious to take over. And it's very difficult often to know what, you know, it's only in retrospect that one can see, I guess, what you've written. I remember when Alan Hollinghurst was here quite a few years ago for the Open Book Festival, I did an interview with him for the Afrikaans newspapers, and he said, and it's a statement that has stayed with me, he said it always takes him a few interviews after he's published the book to find out what the book is about. And to me at least, that's very much how it works. It seems one is, you can only sort of reverse, it's not as if you don't think while you write, but there's, you know, when you speak about a novel in the sort of fashion that we are tonight, it seems that there's a lot of reverse engineering happening. It's a very different thing to speak about the novel in this way than it is to think about it while you're writing it. I'm also surprised also at how non-verbal, in a sense, that sort of thinking is while you're writing the novel. It's as if the words sort of form this thin sort of crust on the surface of what you were planning to write.
That's an interesting image, because there's a sense, not just with this book, of names sitting again on a kind of a crust. There's a baby that has no name, where there's in fact a reference like that about using an old name that sits on top of something. There's also a sense that you know, buildings, however elaborate they may be in their construction, end up as ruins, as kind of empty spaces. And in all your writing, a kind of pushing towards what's underneath the elaborate facade, something much more basic. My fear with this conversation was that, you know, I would run out of questions, but actually, as usual, it's turned inside out, and I realize I'm not going to begin to get to most of the questions I want to ask.
Sorry to be so long-winded.
No, that wasn't my point. There are some things I do want to touch on, because I wouldn't want people to take an incorrect impression away from the novel. I think of this as your best work, for what that's worth. It leaves a very, very powerful after impression, quite a haunting after impression, and it's very hard to know precisely how you achieve that. You may not have the answer to that either. There is a deep melancholy in a lot of your work. In this particular book, Daniel himself is a queer man whose connections are often very transitory. The kind of connections that might mark out somebody else's life are not present, as in a long-term relationship, or again, family relationships, even though the book is about fatherhood, which is one of the primal connections that we have. The attempts at fatherhood that various characters make generally fail. The Serbs, there's a point which Daniel is described as having fatherly concern about these two Serbs. That fatherly concern does not save them from their fate. And again, at other points in the book, Daniel's prepared to take on a kind of a fatherly role to people who are not his children. But these efforts, once more, don't lead to fulfillment or success. It would be very easy to get the impression that your book is profoundly depressing. It wouldn't be incorrect to say that it, you know, depicts a world in which human connections are transitory and doomed to failure. And yet, do you think there's again, I don't want to give away the details of your story, which are in themselves quite intricate and interesting, But the real family in this book, the one that Daniel goes with or settles for, is one that's chosen rather than allotted, if I can put it like that. Do you see some sense of hope, human connection in chosen family rather than the one that life bestows on us?
Yes. I think, the chosen family here is also in part blood family. It's also a cousin.
Yes. Not a close relationship, which is part of the point. Yeah.
It's not the immediate nuclear family.
It becomes close at a moment of choice rather than the obvious route that such a connection might follow.
Sure. I think, again, doing some reverse engineering, I think one of the questions that the book asks is, what kinds of fatherhoods might be possible in what kinds of conditions? For instance, one, is it possible to be a good father in a brutalized society? If you think of the period within both Daniel and his cousin Theon grew up in, what kind of fatherhood was possible for his father? Given the kind of values and perspectives and the assumptions about masculinity that might have hung in the air, that might have been the dominant values of the time, kind of masculinity that might entail notions around the exercise of or performance of a display of power, physical prowess. Dominance, authoritarianism, and the question is, can one be a good father in that sort of society, in the society that Daniel and his cousin Theon grew up in? And what kind of resistance, perhaps, would it take, internal and external resistance to this kind of world, would it have taken by their fathers to be good fathers? And I think the two men then attempt to, in a sense, reinvent fatherhood by constructing, as you say, a sort of new, choosing a sort of family, constructing, or attempts at least to construct a family. There are doomed attempts, ultimately. But I think the question, and you talk about, I wouldn't mention his name, but he's here. A friend of mine said, when he read the book, yes, he liked the book and it's quite good, but he doesn't quite have the stomach for such misery. I see it differently. I don't quite, I think of my own work as sneakily utopian in a sense. There are at least glimpses of, in some of the relationships or the potential of some of the relationships, there are at least glimpses of what could be almost of the photo negative of the world that is being depicted or the world that makes certain kinds of relationships impossible. And the glimpses of other kind of possibilities in terms of human relationships that is that play out visible, suggest, I think, that there's a different sort of world, another possible world, and where everything is very different, right underneath the surface of this. If I think back on my previous novel, The Third Reel, which dealt with young people who were living in squats in London in the 1980s, and they had these, rather sort of naive ideas about what kind of different life. It's the era of Thatcher in London, but there are these somewhat naive ideas about what could be possible, how you could live and love freely and make art freely and so on. It's as I say, it's all a little bit embarrassing in a sense. They think, through living a certain kind of a life that involves, you know, drugs and rock and roll in a sense, and that might not be the right route. But I think there's always a sense of an attempt to find a route to a different kind of world and where different relationships are possible. And I think there's a very concerted attempt by Daniel and Theon towards the end of this book to recreate that, also rather to reinvent, you know, what is possible in terms of choosing a family, constructing a family, constructing a new kind of fatherhood, you know, fatherhood that might not, that also is also accompanied by a different kind of masculinity, you know, masculinity that entails perhaps, you know, rather than teaching your son to kick a ball, that might rather entail, you know, tenderness and teaching empathy and ethical instincts. So I think that the beginnings or the first, as I said, few glimpses of what else could be possible, and in large part that is constituted by that choosing of a different family or an attempt at constructing something from scratch in that sense.
For this reader, at least, that element has always felt consoling in the kind of universe that you evoke. I'm not sure this is something you'd want to respond to, but it seems to me that almost, I mean, I'm speaking very broad terms, there are almost two worlds that come up continually in your writing. The one, for want of a better description, is the established cultural world. Daniel's father's an investment banker. His sister's made a sensible marriage, and her concern is money, having enough money for herself and for her children and so on. These are things that a lot of people would relate to as the constructed meaning that humans have built. Daniel, on the other hand, is very typical of a lot of your characters. He leads what you describe as a meandering, drifting life, which doesn't seem separate from his vocation as a writer. And there is this perpetual antagonism between the meandering, drifting world of the writer and the much more established, willfully meaningful world of human culture, for want of a better term. And it seems to me that your books like to evoke a kind of in-between space that is almost, again, for want of a better term, surreal. You know, your previous collection of stories was called Mad Honey, which is a juxtaposition of two words that in a sense shouldn't fit together. But they evoke something, Mad Honey, which is a kind of a surreal reality of its own, which is beautiful but also kind of free-floating, if I can put it that way. Does this strike any spark with you? In other words, I'm saying where another writer might use the work to articulate a very particular meaning, it seems to me that you're using language in a way that dances around a central empty space, a lack of meaning, in other words. So
yes, but it's also trying to give meaning to that, or to create some sort of space. And it's not, it's related, I think, to the previous answer I gave in the sense of there seems to be some sort of attempt by the characters in each of my stories and each of my novels to find some sort of escape route, you know, whether it's through, you know, sometimes, as I say, through naive and unsuccessfully through naive routes, you know, some sort of form of swimming in a sense, you know, whether it be taking drugs or you know, a certain approach to sex or whatever it might be, some attempt at an escape route to what might in a primitive way be constructed as some alternative world, you know, some, as I say, some idol, something which is the total negative of the world of conventions that you describe. they seem to be quite unsuccessful attempts mostly. But there are glimpses of other possibilities constantly, and maybe it just takes another novel, another collection of stories to find the Elysium.
I could really go on and on, but I've used up far more than my allotted time, and I'm sure that people would like to ask questions, so I will hand over to the floor to let that happen.
Hi, really enjoyed your book. It's my first time reading a local book. I'm very much normally into long world-building fantasy stories, but my wife forced me to read this one to get a broader view of, and I must say I really, really enjoyed it. It was amazing. But in terms of world-building and that, I see in this book you have the real world, but you have your version of the real world. Then all the places that your characters went to, did you have any thoughts of, this is how I want the walls of this place to be, this is how I want the interactions of this place to be? Did that factor in your writing at all?
I think we touched on it in our discussion. I think the, you know, I think there's a kind of anxiety on my side, not knowing one sort of world sufficiently well to set an entire novel in it. That's perhaps in part why there's a certain kind of nervous energy in the geographical shifts in the book. You know, to a certain degree, I think those. And of course, you know, it means that there's, as you say, world building. There's quite a lot of world building because there are constantly new geographical, cultural spaces that feature. Yes, I mean, and as I said earlier, I think that sometimes the plot is revived in a sense or energized by moving to a different geographical space. I'm not sure how much more I can say. It's, you know, it isn't world building in the sense of, you mentioned fantasy novels, or it isn't world building in the sense of fantasy novels or science fiction where you have to imagine an entirely different or future world. The novel, interestingly, does, you know, does span the span of the novel. It projects into the future. So the the fifth part of the novel is set in, I think, roughly about 20, 25 years from now. Even though there are actually very few markers that might actually indicate, you know, what that future in fact looks like. Apart from just this one sort of narrow space being the farm and what has happened to that farm in the meantime. But the kind of world building that happens in science fiction, I think, is of another order.
The idea of short stories, dare I say, versus the novel. Now, to my mind, and as you know, I'm a novel person, the novel has a certain trajectory, which very often is connected to a development in the central character. I suppose I'm describing a 19th century novel here. Now, interestingly, Deborah Steinmar, in a very appreciative review, suggested that Daniel is perhaps a rather cold, self-involved person. That was not my reading of him, but once that suggestion had been put in my mind, I thought, well, it is possible to read this novel as Daniel moving from a position of self-enclosure. For instance, what you read, he's actually quite cruel to his father. And then via Tian and his relationship with Tian, arriving at something much more, I suppose, open to other people and other people's feelings. In other words, that there is a trajectory which I would associate with a novel rather than a short story. Now, I don't know how you feel about that, that reading of Daniel is actually moving from one position to another.
Yes, again, that's one of those cases where one has to cast some sort of searchlight back over the novel that we've written. I think Daniel is definitely not the same person. Well, it's much, much older as well, decades older in the last section than he was in the first. And is very much not the same person. Whether that is, you know, whether the reviewer that you mentioned, whether her description of how it changes is exactly how I would describe it, I don't know. And I would definitely say this is a novel. This is where, you know, someone has once mentioned, someone referred to some of my short story collections as an imploded novel or a, you know, fragmented novel or something along those lines. I think this is much more of a novel, and it's not a 19th century novel. It doesn't have the satisfactions and the equilibriums and the closures that a 19th century novel might have. And I would say that different pieces are quite episodic. But then, you know, if I think of Damon's last novel, it's probably also quite episodic in a sense. Yes, I think Daniel's certainly not the same person at the end that he was in the beginning, but I'm not sure I would want to necessarily venture an analysis of how he's different towards the end.
Well, as you say, you only find out what your novel is about once you have your first launch.
It takes a few launches, in fact, I think. I'm just really starting to find out these things.
Death is a very constant presence in all your work. I was quite struck by a particular description in this book about death as being a path of light, and the moment of death itself being the point when the light becomes absolutely blinding. It seems an almost religious image in its way.
Can you remind me where that?
Someone else wrote it. You don't recall that description?
Yes,
it made quite a big impression.
It's there is a lot of death. I mean, I actually went back and counted. The toll is high.
The toll is very high, almost like on a Hamlet scale. Everyone's dead.
yes, at least there are several funerals.
I was hoping you were going to throw out a very hopeful metaphor, and instead you can't even remember writing.
We're talking about routes of escape and then swooning and characters trying to find a way out into some sort of other kind of some world which in many ways are the opposite of the paradigm of conventions that they feel tied into. So I think that sort of fantasy of death as some sort of the route of blinding light towards some other place that probably fits into that paradigm, I would suggest.
A fantasy, alas.
It's a form of swooning.
I really could and would love to carry on chatting to you, but I think we've run out of time, and Merlin's very strict. He spanks you if you go over time. So,
spanking session incoming. I want to ask one last question. Comment, possibly with a question mark at the end of it. You said earlier you expressed frustration about the sort of fight for the short story as a, I don't want to say as a genre, as a form. And I'm a little curious about that because, I mean, if I think we opened the shop 15 and a half years ago, and there were people then who said short stories don't sell, poetry doesn't sell, you know, all that crap. I mean, it's been around forever in the book trade. My sense is not of a contracting of that space for the short story, for short story collections. There's definitely an expansion in terms of the kinds of collections which offer up a space for new writers, right?
Sure.
And sort of prize shortlists and all that kind of thing. But I mean, I'm going to say something about the book festival in a couple of minutes, but off the top of my head, there are three brand new short story collections being published between now and then, which are going to be featuring at the festival. That's no less than you know what was happening X number of years ago.
I think there isn't a linear trajectory necessarily, and it differs between different countries. I think in the United States, short stories are published and read quite widely. In the UK, in the 70s and 80s, short stories were very popular, but I think it's changed entirely, and most British publishers won't even read a short story unless you're a very established novelist and unless you offer a novel with your collection of short stories. But British publishers, in my experience, generally won't look at short stories. I think South Africa is also different. I think there's there isn't such an antagonism. So I think it really does depend. I don't want to generalize.
Thank you.